Chapter 7, Numbers. Denton, recidivist. I found that Pat and Tricia's old house, whose garage I'd camped in, was now divided into single rooms for rent, with a shared kitchen and bath. So I moved back to the ancestral Fry Street. I decided to get into the mood to study by wearing a vest, and sometimes even a three-piece suit. It matched my predilection for pockets and pocket watches. I had yet to own a wristwatch. The idea of a machine on my organic grain-fed arm was unbearable. My apartment was across Oak Street from the Corkscrew Beer and Wine Store and diagonally across from the Sigma Alpha Mu fraternity. It was a real animal house situation, and I frequently called the cops early in the morning to get them to shut up so I could sleep. They would heckle me as I walked past in my new uniform. "Hey, man, get with it! It's 1981! To which I thought, yes, temporarily. A few years later, they solved the problem by burning down the place. SSI payments started in mid-November, giving me the princely sum of $260 a month, plus food stamps and Medicaid, so at long last, I was financially secure. I started off with a dual major in computer science and math, with physics on the side. It was soon obvious that computers were extremely boring, and by the spring semester, I'd changed to a physics and math double major with extreme pain on the side, specifically my left side. The hip deteriorated during the fall, so that I went from one cane to two, and finally to crutches. The x-rays showed bone that looked like Swiss cheese and tendons that looked like bone. By late December, there were times I couldn't reach my feet and so could no longer dress myself. Medicaid paid for home health care for 15 hours a week starting in January, which later expanded to 20 hours. I had a great teacher in physics, Miles Anderson, and really took to the subject. That fall, I got a 99 average, and he let me skip the final. For the first month in both physics and math, there was a very interesting woman, Suzanne, who dropped both classes. She was affectionate, and I had high hopes that we could be a couple. But she lost interest after about a week, and in December moved to Austin to study microbiology. To give you an idea of this time, here is an account from my friend Rick Denton, a temporarily Mormon fellow student I met in this class. Back in the bad old days of undergrad college, bad because I was too poor to score with chicks, too funny looking for same, and not smart enough to give up, I fancied myself a smart young Turk with a future in engineering, physics, or math. Classical physics, which seems like child's play today, was particularly perplexing in that I couldn't seem to remember anything that was helpful on an exam. I decided to hang with people who were doing well, which led me to all the Mormon physics students. This didn't work out, because I wasn't smart enough to master the realm of the Newtonian universe, while simultaneously professing Native Americans are Jews who built temples based on stolen blueprints from the pyramids at Giza, and that reality stems from a man who read sacred plates while sticking his head in a hat. Go figure. I decided a new approach was needed. Now, back in freshman physics, our instructor had an interesting technique for violating the secrecy that guarded which student got which grade. When an exam came back, he would put the grades up on the board, then proceed to hand out the exams in descending grade order. From this secret wink-wink method, I made two profound observations. The highest grade in the class was always a minimum of 10 points higher than the next best grades. the latter usually belonging to some Persian guys who sat on the back row. And that first returned exam always went to the same guy who sat center front. He walked with a cane, sans sword, had a long, pointy red beard, and had a habit of hiking his eyebrows into two McDonald's arches whenever someone said something banal, bourgeois, or just plain stupid. For example, "Wow, that last test was a killer." Bill, eyebrows up. "Was it? That's good information. I guess you got the high grade." Bill, single arch. "Well, if you think that sort of thing is important. Would you like to study together?" Bill, twin arches, expression of disbelief. "What a novel idea. That could be interesting." That was Bill. Now, Bill was a little different then than today, as age, maturity, and a pathological need to build radios to talk to the dead will do to a person over time. His maddening ability to remember pages from the Tipler physics book and quote passages from memory, for instance. "You know, Bill, I keep confusing the formulas between momentum and acceleration." Bill, "I see. Yes, I think I can help. If you'll just recall, looking up at the ceiling, Tipler, page 242, left column, third, complete paragraph. Acceleration is the time derivative of velocity. Yada, yada, yada." 10 years after college, I visited him to help me solve a problem in thermodynamics, and he pulled the same crap. If this is what guys in physics are like, I needed to find a profession with dumber people I could hope to compete with. The narrative resumes. The local macro crowd of maybe a dozen people had regular potluck dinners at Terence and Gwen's home. I didn't realize it, but my attitude had become cynical, especially under the duress of my condition. I was starting to make unpopular, challenging remarks about the faith, which strained my friendships. In November, John Cage came to NTSU to give a concert featuring his HPSCHD, a multimedia piece featuring slideshows and live harpsichords and multiple tapes playing at once, and where are my damn earplugs? Since he was macrobiotic, we had him over to our potluck. He made a point of mentioning that he was introduced to macrobiotics by John Lennon, although I don't know how John's heroin addiction fits into the macro scheme of things. I gave him a copy of my I Ching cycle of 21 solo violin sonatas and also the Bhagavad Gita score. He mentioned his own I Ching violin pieces that were determined by chance, which I determined never to have the chance to hear. At school, I saw an excited young student come up to Cage and tell him he'd found a mistake in one of his scores. Cage looked blankly at the page. Clearly, the student didn't quite get the point. You can only make a mistake if by changing the score you make it worse. Cage wouldn't know that he wrote the piece if his name wasn't on the program, which was the style at the time. I was going to write, "wouldn't know that he wrote the piece if he pulled it directly out of his ass," but that would be rude. True, but rude. Violin playing was not possible. I was given an old upright piano and crammed it into my small room. From time to time, I heard the twang of breaking strings, which were very difficult to replace since they dated from the 1930s. John Cage would have appreciated its random self-preparation and autonomous stochastic sound disorganization. I continued work on the Goldbug variations. I bought a 50cc Yamaha motorcycle, which looked quite curious with crutches stashed in the back. One day I took the straightest route between two points, without paying attention to what neighborhoods I went through. When I got to the black part of town, kids threw stones at me. When I told my friends, they said I was foolish not to know this kind of thing would happen. I never went there again. Mom married Burns Westman in April. He taught strings in the Oklahoma City Public Schools, so now she was not very far away. She and Burns drove to Denton for Thanksgiving, and we went on to Grandma's trailer in Tyler in East Texas. I gave my 21 sonatas to Burns, who played both violin and viola, but he never touched them. Over Christmas, I visited with Uncle David at Grandma's and played him a cassette of the variations on the Große Fugue in hopes that the Blair Quartet he played in would take it on. No luck. My Mormon orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Steiner, was an amateur violinist and owned a Strad. Naturally, I gave him music as well, but his long work hours precluded practicing. By March, it was clear that I needed my left hip replaced. I had to wait until after school ended in May, which meant an extra 2 months of severe pain. We tried a series of medications, and I ended up with nonsteroidal anti-inflammatories. When one went bad on me, which I knew by spitting up blood, I went to another, eventually settling on Naprosyn. Side effects included sores on my arms, and the rumor started that I was a heroin addict. I asked Dr. Steiner how long the hip would last, and he said, oh, about 10 years, and I wouldn't be walking at all in 20. A major macrobiotic teacher named Lino Stanchich came through Dallas on his way west, and I joined several Denton macros to see him. I was on crutches and planning on surgery. Lino said I shouldn't have the operation, but instead should use sea salt produced by Nobuo Morimoto. He said that this salt cured all kinds of diseases, including glaucoma. I didn't tell him that the small amount of salt I used had been from Morimoto for quite some time, and I was only getting worse. He had no clue. This was the last time I bothered to listen to any macrobiotic quackery. In early 1982, various members of the large Fleet family showed up in and around Denton. I'll need to use pseudonyms for the bunch of them. Details will be unreliable, as I might improvise. Close enough, though. The Fleets were Irish Catholics from the mid-Atlantic coast. One grandfather served with my maternal grandfather in the army under Black Jack Pershing fighting Pancho Villa in the Southwest Desert. The other grandfather was at Walter Reed Hospital when my maternal grandparents met. The father died in his 40s. Young Bacchus Fleet, 3 years my junior, grew up in an orphanage. He and his brothers Harpo and Groucho and two of his 4 sisters were settling in North Texas. Brother Chico lived on the streets in D.C. It took a year to slowly get to know Bacchus, his family, and colorful friends, such as Big Doug, Breaker of Chairs, and Ulysses, Guzzler of Wine. He made harpsichords, guitars, and lutes used by leading musicians, and prize-winning wings for stunt planes up in Ponder, about 10 miles from Denton. Not bad for a guy who was deep into the bottle. Classes went well, although I took a course in linear algebra that was an endurance contest. One of my classmates said that while listening to a lecture, he looked at his sharpened pencil and wondered if he should continue writing notes or plunge it directly into his heart. I can be forgiven my B. The East-West Foundation in Boston collected macrobiotic case histories. In late March, I sent a write-up of my experiences that was highly critical of macrobiotics and specific teachers. the result was much as expected. They were only interested in collecting and printing positive stories. I sent the paper to Rob Allenson, Michio Kushi, and some friends and family members. Non-macrobiotic friends were delighted I was coming to my senses. I finished the two-piano version of the Goldbug Variations, by far my longest work yet, at 23 minutes. Now I started the orchestral version. I bought an old cheap upright that looked terrible but sounded not too bad, and junked the old free job. No more involuntary prepared piano sounds. Late April, just before the end of the semester, was the annual Fry Street Fair. This started in 1979, but now my house was in the thick of it. It was centered around music performances put on by the Delta Lodge, a nearby fraternity, as a fundraiser for charity. At its peak in 2002, the attendance was 20,000. After that, they tried moving it elsewhere, and the last one was in 2007. One band that appeared at these fairs later won a Grammy for a recording made while tripping on acid I provided. That's as close to a Grammy as I am likely to get, unless they start giving them posthumously. Under the Knife. Classes ended in early May, and a couple of weeks later I arrived at Westgate Hospital. Mom came to town to help out for the first several days. After 5 years of macrobiotics, I was anemic and so weak that while lying on a bed, I couldn't raise my legs. I'd put so little weight on my left leg that all the calluses on the bottom of my feet were gone. They couldn't use gas with my stiff neck, so they used spinal anesthesia. My memory only goes to being on the slab and being turned on my side, but they say I told jokes through the operation. Wish I had a tape of that. When I came to, things seemed under control. Shortly, though, it was evident that the hospital's policy for post-operative pain relief was slanted on the side of not giving enough Demerol, in the spirit of the national drug war hysteria. Other patients in my ward were moaning and screaming, and I joined them in time. But the nurses were stalwart. Every shot that gave me a pain in the ass was a pain in the ass for them to give. My roommate moaned so loudly I couldn't sleep the first two nights, and when I did, there were Demerol-induced nightmares. After 3 days, they stopped the Demerol shots and started giving me useless pills. The new hip became infected, and my thigh swelled to about twice its normal size. Dr. Steiner took a 100cc syringe with an ominous-looking spike for a needle, put it into my wound until he reached the bone, and pulled on the piston to see if he could extract some pus. He didn't get much except an example of how loudly I could yell. After much IV antibiotics, the infection eased. At first, I was on an all-liquid diet. I'd requested vegetarian fare, but the first meal they brought me was beef broth. I reminded them of my request, and they said, "Oh, don't worry, it's all just synthetic chemicals. There's no actual beef in it." After a week of lying on my back, it was time to sit up and start exercising. However, despite the 9 units of blood they'd put in me, I lost vision and most other senses when I tried to sit on the edge of the bed. It was terrifying. It took about a week to be able to get out of bed and start physical therapy. This was during the time when HIV was in the blood supply, and there was no test to detect it. I dodged the bullet. I came home after 27 days of hell in the hospital. Slowly over the summer, I healed and got stronger, especially as I was eating more rationally with some poultry and fish. I was able to take a multivariable calculus course in the second summer session. My teacher was an avid Mormon, and one day I met him in a local bookstore. I decided to have a little fun with him and picked up a book by Chuang-tzu, a genius of Taoist absurdity. "Pretty good stuff. You should take a look at it," I offered. He looked at me like I was liable to be damned on the spot. Well, they can always baptize me after I'm dead. Rent assistance came through, and I moved 2 doors down to a real 1-bedroom apartment. By fall, I was back in traces with the 3rd semester of physics and more math courses. Things were on the mend. I was making friends, getting great grades, enjoying my work, and putting together a recital for November. By October, I could walk without a cane. My anti-inflammatory drugs seemed to work pretty well, and I felt better than I had for years. I wrote up my wave matrix theory and puzzled my teachers with its convoluted transcendental guesswork. And in late July, I started Symphony No. 2. In September, rehearsals started for my concerts coming up in November. I got a couple of graduate students to take on the Goldbug Variations, a good student violinist to play Sonata for Unaccompanied Violin No. 19, and Fido to play Piano Sonata No. 1. To leaven this heavy stew, I wrote another spoken chorus piece to go along with Little Miss Nonfat, this one called Math Class, or Does the Zero Have Buddha Nature? Both were compulsory encores to be belted out by 4 good friends under my direction called Christian Science and the Monitors. Maybe things weren't so bad after all. Just when things were looking up, Anton ended up doing 60 days starting in mid-October at Lewisburg in Pennsylvania, the same country club prison where Wilhelm Reich was incarcerated and died, with mostly white-collar criminals. He had a private room in a quiet, all-Caucasian section. His contacts and trainings prepared him for a career in finance. One of his fellow inmates was George Marquardt from Oklahoma. He was a high school dropout who taught himself physics and chemistry after being captivated by an anti-drug film in which a mouse on LSD chased a cat. In 1965, at age 20, he impersonated an official of the Atomic Energy Commission specializing in isotope development and was hired by a Milwaukee college as a lecturer in physics. His dream was to be a wizard of chemical synthesis, and so made AZT for AIDS sufferers who couldn't afford the drug. He also made the key component for nerve gas for survivalists in the Northwest. In 1978, he was busted for mixing his LSD with methamphetamine, which is how Anton got to know him in the pokey. By now, he was convinced he was the Lord of Nanana Boo Boo, a sort of human-machine interface region, and was too far out for even Anton to associate with. In 1991, I spoke with some heroin addicts from Washington, D.C., who described their excitement when they heard that some China White had arrived in New York that was killing addicts. They all jumped in a car and raced north to try and find some. This was fentanyl, an extraordinarily toxic chemical, very difficult to make, that was passed off as synthetic heroin. A dose the size of 3 sugar grains could be fatal. Dealers were carelessly cutting the China White, leading to as many as 300 deaths in 1991 and 1992 on the East Coast. Finally, in February 1993, DEA agents closed in on the source. Sure enough, it was George Marquardt, who had a very sophisticated lab in Goddard, Kansas. His release date is November 2014. Across town at TWU, a woman walking across campus after dark was raped by a black man about 20 years old. He was arrested and told the detective that he was going to raise hell until they put him in prison for good, and there was nothing they could do to stop him. Even so, they let him out on a $30,000 bail. I was enjoying my new ability to walk one night, just after sundown in October. I'd dressed in white pants, white shirt, white shoes, and white jacket. Quite the fashion plate. A couple blocks from my home, I looked around me and saw 10 feet behind a black man and no one else in sight. There was a very strong thought, this man is your nemesis. But I dismissed it as paranoia and continued on my way. A few seconds later, I saw a brilliant white flash and a terrible pain in the back of my head. I fell to the ground on my back and saw that I had been hit with a short tree limb in this man's hands. I said, what do you want? And he said, give me your fucking money. Out of laziness, I kept rather too much of my SSI check in my wallet and gave him $100. He swung the stick at my right shin and broke it, then ran off. People in nearby houses heard my screams and called the cops. The ambulance took me to Flo Hospital, where Dr. Steiner put a cast on my leg. The first person I called was Anshul Brusiloff, whose first words were, why did you call me? Good point. I got to know a very friendly and capable detective who told me about the rapist out on bail, and I picked his picture out of a collection. They rounded him up and got him off the streets. Meanwhile, I was now in a wheelchair, since my left hip was not fully healed and my right shin was now broken. I couldn't handle the strain of pushing it around since I had arthritis in my shoulders and little strength. Thankfully, that only lasted a week, and I was able then to walk with crutches. I never could have made it without my home health aid. I had to drop out of school. My teachers encouraged me to just take a break and get back into classes in time to keep going that semester, but this was just one blow too many. Due to the way courses were sequenced, missing this semester would mean adding a year to get a degree. With so many reverses and difficulties, I just wanted to do whatever I felt like and enjoy life as much as I could. If things were going to be this hard, I wouldn't be able to hold the physics job anyway on graduation, at least any that I'd seen offered. I just wanted to rest. For several months, I had occasional seizures due to the head trauma. My grades were so good that, at the end of the spring semester, I got a prize for being the best sophomore physics student, even though I'd only done 2 of the 9 months. When walking down the street on my crutches, from time to time, cars full of angry black men would drive by and give me the finger, threatening me because I'd gone to the police. I made sure to stay in places where many other people could protect me from attack. It helped that my health aide was a large black woman who wasn't going to put up with any nonsense. I asked the detective what the policy was on weapons. There was no way I could use physical strength to defend myself, which is what invited the assault in the first place. He said there was a law against carrying concealed firearms, but in my case, if I had a pistol and had shot the guy, they would have fined me $140, taken the gun, and that's it. This was Texas, after all. With all my pacifism and peaceful way of life and yoga and devotion and we're all one and all the New Age stuff, if I had a gun, I would have shot my attacker. Maybe losing his testicles would change his life for the better. So I went to a gun store and checked it out. It seemed like the guy behind the counter really wanted to be assaulted so that he could kill someone. I couldn't pack heat, so I just learned to live with the fear. A few months later, the detective wanted me to testify at the sentencing of the mugger after he was convicted for the rape at TWU. They didn't bother prosecuting him for my mugging. I went down and did an interview, but it turns out that Texas law forbids testimony by anyone who knew the convicted person directly. The only allowed testimony was by people who knew him purely by reputation. Since I'd been mugged, I knew him from him being on the other end of a stick, and thus had no input as to his fate. This was bizarre beyond belief, but that's the law for you. A succession of cops who had heard about the convict got on the stand and were asked by the prosecutor, what is his reputation? They all said just one word, bad. Somehow the defense got permission to call his mother their only witness. The lawyer asked her one question, if he'd had any previous felony convictions, and she said no. He got 30 years to life, but the detective said with his attitude, he'd not last long in Huntsville. My friend Terry Brown was a big help. He was a technical whiz who set up my custom speakers and stereo system from his giant pile of spare gizmos packed away in his apartment, sharing space with his 30 cats. When we drove around town, he would take extraordinarily convoluted routes to try and avoid any intersection with police, although he'd never broken a law in his life, except for his penchant for stopping at green lights. He figured out how to rewire cassette players so that he could play tapes at a fraction of their original speed. The effect was stunning when applied to recordings of his cats yowling. After his untimely death in 1994, his landlord took 4 months to clear out his belongings and then found another dumpster load in the attic. Terry used to play some of the 80 cassettes recorded by the immortal Dr. Peter Beter. These were entertaining, paranoid rants, including long lists of coordinates for Soviet missiles placed in major American harbors. Peter thought David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, and Jimmy Carter were actually dead and were impersonated by organic robotoids. Jack T. Chick, the most published comic book author in the world, used Peter Beter as a reference for his evangelical screeds. It was good to know that someone was continuing the tradition of anti-Illuminati paranoia, setting the stage for Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh. The show must go on. Break a leg. Cast or no, I had a concert to give on November 18th, my first in 5.5 years. We played to 20 people with no musicians in the audience. 3 math and physics faculty members came, which I appreciated. This meant that I worked about 6 weeks for every person who filled the chair. Now I had a recording I could reproduce on cassettes and show people my work. Fido had a job playing piano in an upscale restaurant and thought it might be interesting to insert the mellow, easygoing, practically tonal middle movement of my piano sonata into his playlist. After he finished, the owner came up to him and said, "If you ever play anything like that again, you're fired." My first review. In January 1983, I finished the copywork on my Symphony No. 2 and sent a copy to Anshul Bruslaw. He left NTSU in the spring of 1982 and now is teaching and conducting at SMU in Dallas. I don't have his response recorded, but I did have the impression that he would play it in the following year, as he had promised before. He did not. His replacement at North Texas was Jeffrey Simon, a conductor from a rich Australian family. I sat down with him 2 or 3 times, and when I submitted my Symphony No. 1, he said, and I won't attempt the accent, "I don't like the cover. I would never play anything you gave me, even if you wrote another Eroica." Problem was, I wasn't Australian. The former crew of sycophants surrounding Bruslaw was now replaced by a new crew of Australian sycophants. As it was unlikely that they would hire a conductor from Denton with a bent for Hinduism, I had little chance for an orchestral performance any time soon. Simon was widely disrespected amongst the musicians and lasted 2 years. Peter Fernberger was studying film and working in a camera shop in New York City when he met Bronwyn Woodhead from Perth, Australia, in his film class. She already had a cat named Pete and a snake also named Pete, so he married her. They went on to have 4 children, none of whom is named Pete for some reason, and still live in New York. Early 1983 was a difficult time. My anti-inflammatory drugs were not working so well anymore, and my right hip was hurting ominously. I had no prospects for music, and was out of formal physics studies, and lost my grounding in friendships in macrobiotics. I was lying in my bed in considerable despair one day, with the door locked, when suddenly I couldn't move. Someone came in the front door, although I couldn't make out a distinct image of who it was. He, she, it came over to me, and I thought he was going to beat me. Instead, he put his hands on my abdomen and shot high-energy prana into me, flooding my body. It was a very high experience, and all the fear left. Then he walked away, pausing for a moment to take my phone off the hook before leaving out the front door. A few minutes afterwards, when I'd landed but still was sparkling from the energy, I noticed a beeping sound. It was the phone, making the noise from being off the hook. I got up and put the receiver back on the cradle, then checked the front door, which was still locked. There you have it. Whoever it was had left physical evidence that this was not just a dream or mental delusion. But, true to the rules of the game, it was not evidence I could record or show skeptics. Peculiar Friendships, Spring and Summer 1983. I got more familiar with the local countercultural scene and made many new friends. One was the remarkable Albert Most. Al had been in the army during what he described as an attack of the stupids. When his remarkable intellect returned, he became a resident assistant at a dorm at NTSU. His taste was to the exotic, and that summer he wrote a scholarly booklet, Bufo Alvarius, The Psychedelic Toad of the Sonoran Desert, published by Venom Press. This concerned the Colorado River toad, also known as the Sonoran Desert toad, after its habitat. It's a huge toad, the largest found in the United States, reaching 7 inches long and almost as wide. Bufo alvarius is the only animal that synthesizes a DMT compound, which has to be smoked. Rumors of the efficacy of licking toads are much exaggerated, and other toad venoms are toxic. The toad's chemical of interest, 5-MeO-DMT, is powerful but relatively safe, producing a trip of only a few minutes in duration. A dose of LSD reaching similar levels of continuum plasticity would mean a trip of 10 or 15 hours, one of its great disadvantages. After this publication, the school authorities took a dim view of Al's accurate and practical scholarship, and he moved into private digs. Eventually, he joined Rainbow Valley, a property north of town settled by various hippie-type people in search of a more back-to-the-land-but-not-too-damn-far-away lifestyle. This was a sister settlement to the already established White Hawk, a community of ferro-cement earth-sheltered homes built by their owners starting in the 1970s. I started gravitating to both communities, but my physical condition and low income made living off the grid and building a house impractical. Turns out, the buildings at White Hawk were built without properly waterproofing the cement, leading to chronic leakage problems once the buildings were buried. But the idea was very attractive given the harshness of North Texan weather and the occasional tornado. There was a free-form, improvised quality to the curved walls and a feeling of community and security with no dependence on the utility companies. Some of the architecture got a touch exotic out at Rainbow Valley. The most expensive home was a very large underground ferro-cement structure, but the owner insisted on having big-picture windows. As a result, he had one whole glassed wall with the view of a retaining wall about 8 feet away. To make sure the view was well worth it, the retaining wall was constructed of expensive redwood timbers. Several members of both White Hawk and Rainbow Valley used their construction experience and skills for employment. One Rainbow dweller remodeled homes. His own house was ferro cement, not yet buried, and appeared to the casual observer as a rocky bump in the ground, covered with tarps held down with large tires. I saw his van, festooned with his advertisement, parked in front of the bump, and asked Albert, "Can he make my house look like his? How does he do it? Fire?" Two local music groups caught my attention. One was B.L. Lacerda, named after an active galactic nucleus. Their keyboardist and percussionist was David Anderson, son of my physics teacher, Miles. I tried to interest them in my music, but they played paintings and other exotic objects. A notable performance was at a home for mentally disabled adults, where they had a big howl-along. It came off better than most stuff from the professors of composition. The other was Brave Combo, which pioneered nuclear polka. Again, I was interested in submitting something for them, but there was a drastic mismatch, what with all the dots on paper I produce and they don't read any of. Too bad. An exotic couple I started spending time with was Gerald Blow and his girlfriend Carolyn. I'd met Gerald back in the early days of the Infinity Food Co-op. He had been an advertising art major, the same field as my mother at North Texas, graduating in 1973. He met Carolyn at a Brave Combo concert in 1980. Gerald made a transition to technical art and worked for the Institute of Applied Science in the General Academic Building, a faceless brick monstrosity built during the Less is More architectural delusion. There, he dabbled in drawing spuria, inconsequentia, and insignifica of geological obscurity for unread papers to be filed back when people used paper for such things. His landlord kicked him out in 1982 in order to house a derelict son, and Gerald decided, who needs rent? The General Academic Building was a big place with a fair number of amenities, and a person could find ways to hang out and keep clean and rested. He took the passenger seat out of his 1968 Datsun 510 four-door sedan, which gave room to stretch out, and parked in imaginative places over the next 10 years, such as down by the lake or in an abandoned garage. He also house-sat when friends were out of town. With his stuff in storage and only a P.O. box as a permanent address, he was set, and Carolyn didn't run away, he had it made. Another fellow I got to know about this time was Rodin, a big, cheerful fellow from Baton Rouge. He was studying music with a minor in dissipation, and NTSU was the place to do it. I gave him my tape and scores, and he appreciated my music, something quite rare in those days. For the next 20 years, Rodin and Gerald were my audience of two. Over the winter, things got tense with Terence. For some reason, he couldn't carry on a simple conversation without telling a lie. His whole moral sense was severely out of shape. He decided, without asking his wife, that they should have a celibate marriage, but he would be free to see any woman he pleased. At one potluck held at his home, he left early with a woman, and Gwen had to explain it away as giving her a ride home, much to her mortification. I was anxious to settle the legal issues of Infinity Natural Food Store, since I was one of the many co-op members legally liable for unpaid taxes. Terence still hadn't registered the store as a non-profit organization, still had no books, and still paid no taxes. I asked him to call a meeting of co-op members, and he said he would, but didn't. I insisted, asking for the list of members so that I could contact them, and he responded by destroying the list. No one else had access to the bank deposits or records, so members didn't know how much money was at stake. Finally, our relationship broke down completely, as I have never been able to deal with people who lie to my face repeatedly. That's entirely my fault. Had I been a more mature friend, I would have found a way to help him recover. Instead, as I had warned would happen, the IRS came to visit the store and closed it down. Terence by then was divorced and lost the house, which belonged to Gwen. He took the store money and assets and in time became a recluse. The last time I saw him, he was chugging beers in a bar. I've tried contacting our mutual friends over the years, and no one has seen him for some time, although he does live in Denton. I believe he's holed up with his mother. It's a very sad story. We were close friends, and I relied on his guidance for many things. The guided meditations we did were the core to my research in transcendental physics. It saddens me to this day. In the spring, a brilliant stoner friend of mine, who knew more about classical music than I did, but didn't make any music himself, graduated and went off to China to teach English. Late in the year, I got a mysterious unsigned postcard from China that read as follows. Dear Bill, or should I say Mr. Robinson, after my accident, the doctors recommended contacting people who might help me regain my memory. Your name was on a list in my pocket when they pulled me from under the train. The other name was Klaus Barbie, but he's apparently not answering his mail. This is extremely important to me, as you can imagine, especially since they tell me when I'm sufficiently recovered, they'll take me out of the hospital and put me back in the prison. That was some shock. Have you ever seen a Chinese prison? Have you ever seen a Chinese hospital? If you see Mr. Barbie, have him explain things to them. Try as I might, I can't remember where I got a 1945 German passport, the 20,000 marks, or Dr. Mengele's gold ID bracelet.